How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to Borderlines, a Canadian legal podcast. Normally I say immigration podcast, but today's episode is about customs law. We are joined by Samuel Hyman, who in Vancouver is one of the more well-known lawyers who practices in the area of personal customs law, which is when people typically are stopped by the Canada Border Services Agency for having brought in a good that either is prohibited or they did not declare, and they have a customs seizure, and if they are a Nexus cardholder, lose their Nexus. Sam, in this episode, provides answers to numerous questions that we received about this topic, and also in the last 10 minutes of the episode, provides his thoughts on the 2024 budget, and particularly how he thinks that there is a bit of a false dichotomy between governments having to raise taxes or cut spending, whereas if they addressed both tax evasion as well as the distinction between one's immigration status and tax status, that there would be a lot more revenue that government could obtain. Didn't leave as much time as we probably should have for that latter topic, but between both the discussion on customs law as well as the discussion on this one aspect of budgetary consideration that I don't think as many people are familiar with as maybe they should be, or at least consider, I hope you enjoy today's episode. We are joined today by Samuel Hyman, who is a lawyer of many talents, immigration, personal injury, and customs law. And I think you're one of the few lawyers who practices customs law, at least at the personal level, in Vancouver. You're also retiring soon, so everybody who's listening to this going, hey, I have a customs lawyer. Unfortunately, from what I understand, Sam, you are retiring soon.
Fairly imminently, yes.
Well, wow. That is a loss for people who need a lawyer. Honestly, in this complicated area.
Yeah, that and Nexus and all that kind of stuff, which is related to, I just always just like, no, don't ask me, ask Sam.
Well, we'll see how it goes. As I was explaining to Deanna before we got on here this morning, My wife's level of trepidation is significant. And should
What
I
about you being home more?
well, half the what is it, the old story, half the income, twice the spouse, right? But if she's verging on the homicidal, I just may have to come back and work as a manservant for you or Deanna. So there
Oh,
you
that's
go.
so funny. And we have quite a number of questions about this topic. I think it's something that anyone who's ever crossed the border kind of experiences is like, what exactly is going on? I mean, the most confusing incident for me isn't a Canadian customs story. It was I was going to the United States eating an apple as I was going through, and the guy goes, anything to declare, the CBP officer, and I'm like, well, I guess I'm eating this apple. And he says, well, you won't be throwing that out. You won't be throwing your Canadian trash out in the great United States. You will keep that apple core in your car until you leave a few hours from now. And I was just thinking, is that the law? I have no idea what's going on.
Oh.
But it is something that, I think, I mean, what percent of your practice was customs or is customs?
Well, it's varied over the years, a fairly significant portion of it. And God knows you get all sorts of inquiries. I did an awful lot of customs defense work and prosecutions as well. A lot of border related prosecutions involving things like handguns and other
Oh wow.
stuff.
So let's start with the basic question, which is if a Canadian what if it we'll focus on the land border, I think, although maybe the law is the same at the air border. If someone is approaching the Canadian border and is coming to customs, what do they have to declare?
Well, the point is, what you have to do is be truthful about the purpose of your stay and what your what and that may govern it. You just listen carefully to the questions asked. Always declare first and ask questions later, I think would be the golden rule. The problem that you have, and if I can just segue a little bit here, over the last 40 years, what I've noticed is there seems to be less and less opportunity for someone to actually take the step of due diligence to know what they have to do by being able to contact someone at the CBSA and actually get an answer as to what they need to do in any specific circumstance, or what they should declare, or how they should declare it, or what tariff item they need to declare an item under. It used to be that you could have a conversation over the telephone with a customs officer or a supervisor at a port of entry. You no longer have telephone numbers for ports of entry. You could call commodity specialists and get a ruling. While the CBSA has a general phone line, they're very reluctant to give you anything that you could actually rely upon as an answer for what you have to declare.
And actually, even just the customs declaration is far more vague than it was even a couple of years ago. Like, I just came across the border and it didn't ask me what I had purchased. It just said, "Have you exceeded your limits?" And so I was like, no, fine. And so, as you say, Sam, if the objective is to do what the one bus driver across the border once said to us, what was it? Laugh at their jokes, don't make any of your own, and declare everything. But it's hard to don't to know, like, I found that when I used to travel and they asked me to actually break down what the costs were of what I had spent and what, other members of my family had spent, it did make me turn my mind to purchases that I might have just not really engaged with. But now you just come across and you get the little kiosk, you go through, you say, "No, I have not exceeded any of these," and off you go. But it seems it's like a less engaging exercise.
Bluntly put, the simplest thing to do, and believe me, my wife and daughter called me obsessively compulsive about it, is And a few other anatomically challenging things too. But the thing that you really need to do is, and the key here is you got to know what you have and you got to know what to declare. And if you're a returning Canadian, whether you're traveling for 48 hours or a week, a month, a year, you really need to know before you go or go back. And what my practice has been is, and consistently is, before getting to the border, you gather up every receipt that you've got in an envelope. And on that envelope, you make a complete list and tally up of what, if you're at a land border crossing, what everyone in the vehicle has. That is really what you have to do in order to know what you have.
Is there a difference in terms of consequence if you underdeclare by $1 versus underdeclare by $1,000 versus not declare at all?
Absolutely. Look, first of all, to be entitled to an exemption, you have to report the goods or declare the goods. If you don't declare the goods, especially in certain other circumstances, the consequences of losing the exemption can be significant. But generally, over a dollar and under reporting, if you're a trusted traveler, I have seen the most trivial of bases for stripping somebody of their
The trusted
Nexus,
traveler.
the Trusted Traveler Program membership in Nexus, for example. Something as ridiculous as a bag of Skittles in a backpack that was forgotten,
It's always Skittles. I knew a guy with Smarties under the car.
Well,
But even stuff like carrying medication that wasn't in a labeled bottle, like things like that have I've seen too, just like, and I don't know if that goes into a different whole area in terms of just import violations, but I've seen some very interesting and confusing things that ended up putting somebody's nexus status at risk.
And a lot of times, when you're dealing with medications, people do not distinguish, or officers don't distinguish as closely as they should between substances that are controlled or prohibited under the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act versus restricted medications that require a prescription. So when you're traveling, the convention, the best practice would be, I suppose, is, if you've got prescriptions, have them in the bottle or the container that they were provided in. And in some cases, you may want to have your prescriptions with you, particularly if you need a refill somewhere along the way, and you're returning with a prescription or restricted medication required elsewhere.
And even just things where, like, something that is an over-the-counter medication in Mexico, for example, is a prescription medication here. And that's the kind of things that I've encountered as well.
You better know what's in it, to be very, very clear, because some of the over-the-counter medications for severe gastrointestinal conditions that you can simply walk into a pharmacy in certain countries and obtain contain very clearly restricted medications. And if you are subject to a search and secondary, and you've got unexplained syringes in your presence, you're going to have a less pleasant encounter. Now,
Yeah,
what
and I've seen a
about
lot of ones with like mysterious white powder. It always seems to be a white powder, but and as you said, Sam, like in the absence of any testing, they're going to assume it's the bad white powder. And so you better be clear that your electrolyte solution or something is clearly identified
your
and
creatine?
distinguishable.
I'll bet
Yeah,
there's a lot of
exactly.
creatine seizures. What
Oh,
about
I've seen.
over-declaring?
Oh.
Like, is
You
there a
know.
penalty if you're being uber cautious and you just always over-declare?
I would, in my experience, I've had officers. I remember traveling with my daughter coming back from a trip to South America. The officer remarked, "This is the most complete E311 I have ever seen," and over declaring absolutely is not a problem. In my view, better to declare everything and ask or seek advice from the officer later. They may say, after having declared it, that's fine. You don't have to worry about that item. That's a lot better than saying, why haven't you declared this? And I think you'll find that that over declaring is not going to be problematic.
And so let's say that you have underdeclared and CBSA is starting to grill you. What rights do you have at the border in that situation? Do you have the right to call a lawyer? Like, what can you do while you're at the border?
Generally, at the border, if well, of course, under declaring is a question of degree. Generally speaking, if I recall from the enforcement manual, the Customs Enforcement Manual, I think I found it in, I think it was the CBSA Enforcement Manual, Part 5, Chapter 2. I think there was a threshold in there of $100. Before they would start taking administrative enforcement action against you, under declaring, and I'm talking about goods that are permissible that can be imported into Canada as distinct from prohibited items,
Yeah, that's a good
that can't.
distinction. Yeah. Zero threshold for the mysterious white powder.
Exactly. And it seems that the threshold now for criminal prosecution, generally speaking, is a value for duty in excess of $25,000 is what I saw. But it can be much lower as well, depending upon the circumstances. Someone with a history of prior civil, administrative, monetary penalty enforcement could be facing prosecution for lower thresholds just because they don't seem to get it.
But so if they're just saying, you've declared that you said you only got gas, we looked in your trunk, there's boxes of clothes that are all clearly recently purchased. We've seen the receipts. At that point, like, can a person say that they aren't answering any questions until they see their lawyer? If they just refuse to answer any further questions, what happens?
Great question.
Well, if you're generally speaking, when criminal prosecution is being contemplated, when prosecution is being contemplated against the importer will be cautioned. They'll be given their warning about right to counsel and so forth under Section 10 of the Charter. Up until that point, look, CBSA in the normal scheme of things is compellable. You're compellable to answer basic questions. However, let's say that you don't. Well, what are you running the risk of? Well, if you decide not to say anything, and there is a contravention that occurs, you're inviting yourself into an escalation of any penalties for contraventions or violations the further along things go, right?
Wow.
Well, the enforcement, and I guess what we should just quickly distinguish between is two things. There are administrative monetary penalties for customs seizures taken against the goods themselves. And as distinct from that, there is also a separate ability of the CBSA to prosecute the importer for the offense or violation. All right. So you certainly have an obligation to provide accurate information under Section 7 of the Customs Act. And if you withhold or do not provide complete information, that in and of itself could invite a contravention being issued, or you're being issued a contravention for having provided complete and accurate information, right? If you provide incomplete information, that too is a contravention, just as non-report, which would include under-reporting the value.
So here's a question regarding complete information. I recently went into the United States, but the question could be the same coming back. And the CBP officer asked what I had in addition to my children, because I said my children, and they said anything else. And I said, oh, you know, clothes and stuff. And then they waved me through. And I was wondering during the drive down to Seattle, saying and stuff, what would that cover? If, like, suppose they, you know, I had gone into secondary and there had been a prohibited item or something like that. Would saying something like and stuff be this catch-all term that exonerates me?
Well, I'm not licensed to practice U.S. law.
So forget, like, if it's assuming if it's coming the other way, if it's coming the other way.
Yeah, that's right. So coming into Canada, you have an obligation, you know, and you listen to the question being asked and you truthfully answer the question being asked. And usually the question is, what have you purchased or acquired while outside of Canada on this trip, or something along those lines? And then you would report. And yes, I do include the gas purchase, although that clearly is over-reporting. But what's the total value of all the goods you've purchased or acquired?
Sorry, why is that over-reporting? Sorry to interrupt, but just why is that?
Well, they did. It's generally, you know, it's being truthful. But of course, they're not going to tax you on the gas, generally speaking. But, you know, what's the total value of all the goods you've purchased and acquired? And right in there with my receipts for the goods purchased is the gas receipt, you know?
Yeah.
And it's, and you break everything down. And I'll go the further step to confirm that there's no alcohol or tobacco in the purchases that I've made on my shopping trip to Trader Joe's on the day trip.
Yeah. So if you had, do say and stuff in your, I mean, I know you have the receipts and everything that you hand up, but if someone just says, clothes and stuff, and there's a prohibited item in stuff, does saying and being vague on what it is help?
Prohibited items are not going to, you know, being vague about a prohibited item is not going to is not going to cut it. But in terms of people traveling into to a country like Canada as a visitor, you are certainly entitled to bring in your personal effects and clothing and so forth. That doesn't necessarily include, of course, commercial goods, depending upon what the purpose of your trip is. So stuff is not, in the circumstances of having a prohibited item, stuff isn't going to cut it if they find it on a search. Generally, the rule is, and the rule has always been at the that the traveler needs to be given a full opportunity to make their report or declaration, and of course at the border, at the land border, most declarations occur for the traveler or individual in a non-commercial sense. They occur verbally. It's a verbal report when you drive up to the primary line. And it always then became a question of, well, when has the point of finality in the questioning being reached such that you no longer, that you've been given a full opportunity to declare something before you go to secondary, before a search is commenced?
I understand. So it's almost like a, like that with Steve's comment, and stuff tips like it puts them on notice that there are other things, but the inquiry hasn't yet concluded and they would need to conclude it before they could make an assessment as to whether or not that was an under or over declaring, something like that. Is that, does that kind of sum it up.
Yeah, it's a matter of procedural fairness, giving
Right, of
somebody an
course.
opportunity to make a full declaration. And when I worked my way through law school, probably before you and Steve were born, I worked my way
Maybe
through as a
Steve.
customs officer. And it used to be that, you'd be at the primary line and a traveler would be referred to secondary. And generally speaking, the officers would, before searching a vehicle, again, confirm the point of declaration, confirm the point of finality by going through and giving them an opportunity for a declaration before commencing a search. And that doesn't happen anymore. That point of finality is almost always reached at a land border crossing before the referral to secondary. And officers are very cognizant of what they have to do in that circumstance. And two, of course, there is case law that says when you're dealing with airports or cruise ship terminals or train stations where the E311 declaration card, as it was, now replaced by kiosk cards, is you hand the declaration that you've given in writing, you've signed off on your declaration. The moment you hand it to the primary officer, the point of finality has been reached. Now, that I think becomes a more problematic situation for the traveler that really is trying to do the right thing, has some questions, isn't quite sure what they have to report when they get to an airport kiosk. Because, as you know, the kiosk spits out the strip of paper with your declaration on it, and then you go to the officer, and that declaration's already been electronically entered. So, unfortunately, for people who come to the border, you no longer have that option of declare first, ask questions later. It's not as easy as it used to be. And quite frankly, I'm not aware of a situation where somebody actually at the airport more recently with the kiosks actually said, wait a minute, I did this, I've completed this, but I'm not sure I have a question when you get to the primary line. So points of finality are becoming more ingrained, and it's really incumbent upon travelers now to make sure they know what they have, know what the rules are, and make a full report before they hand their declaration to the primary officer at Vancouver Airport, for example,
It's
and
very
similar.
interesting. The erosion of procedural fairness clearly is affecting all of the immigration and customs related things. It's been a subject of much conversation on the podcast. I have a
Don't
question
forget,
though.
oh, I was just going to
Sorry.
say, and don't
Yeah, please.
forget the administrative monetary penalty system. The con These are not specific intent offenses. You don't have to intend to make the mistake. If you just It's just general intent. If you have failed to report, and your only answer and your only defense in these type of offenses to these contraventions is one of due diligence, that you took reasonable steps to avoid running afoul of the law. And if the opportunities to make the inquiry have been diminished, it makes it much harder to establish due diligence as your defense.
I don't even know, like, are these, and this should be obvious perhaps, are these criminal offenses? Are these are regulatory offenses if you do have a customs violation? What are they?
Well, there's two aspects of it. There's the administrative penalty, which is basically a civil statutory offense. And basically, they're strict liability, not absolute strict. On the other hand, under Section 160 of the Customs Act, that is the general offense section that lists all of the various other sections where you can have a contravention civilly, and it can
Double
import into
duty,
the
yeah.
offense. It can import them into the offense section, and they're hybrid offenses. The hybrid offenses,
Wow.
punishable on summary conviction, are maximum punishment of $50,000 and or 6 months in jail. And of course, there's the
And
indictable
indictable.
offenses for the more serious is liable to a fine not exceeding $500,000 or to imprisonment for a term not exceeding 5 years, or to both fine and imprisonment. And that is in addition to the administrative penalties that have been imposed that can be significant.
Yeah, so one question, can have admissibility consequences as well.
Yeah.
When you were working at the border, I know it was a long time ago, and when people were taking their horse-drawn carriages up to the border, what was the note-taking process like at primary? Like, one of the questions we got was, is everything recorded? Like, are they recording us in our cars? When you just drive up and you're speaking to the first CBSA officer, is it all recorded?
I honestly, in my day, you had a notepad, but you also had a form that you would use to make the referral. And they still do these referral forms at the land border.
How do they know? I've always wondered, like, do they press a button? Because how does the person who stands there watching the cars, they seem to always know you're going into secondary. Is it a button? Do you wave it? Like, what?
Well, does this happen to you all the time, Steve? Like, you're a regular visitor at secondary?
There was a period. There was a period.
Okay. Youth. Misguided youth.
Exactly. Well, basically, back in the day, I feel like Inspector Luger and Barney Miller here, but back in the day, no idea
who that is.
Yeah, maybe Deanna is.
I remember Barney Miller, but
yeah,
that's about as far
anyhow,
as I go.
The issue is, normally what would happen is an officer would complete a form. There would even be a coded notation, or there'd just be a notation, and that would indicate, you know, referred to secondary for search. And it would be handed to someone. It'd be handed to the traveler, and then they would be instructed to pull over, park, and go inside. And today, I haven't been blessed with having the opportunity of a full tour of the facility in the last few years. So I would imagine that, you know, very careful note-taking at a minimum.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Yeah, my husband always is absolutely certain that from like 10 miles out that everything we say is like being listened to through a Whisper 2000 or whatever, but he's just watched too many spooky movies.
I thought there was something where interestingly, the Calgary airport, they're able to hear things or something.
Right. Interestingly, going south, there are cautions now about, I believe, they were going to start recording so that conversations would be picked up, but I don't believe that became an issue traveling north.
Interesting. I mean, sometimes you wish that it was recorded because, I mean, at least in the immigration context, sometimes I wish those call center calls or officer interviews were recorded rather than the transcription. But I guess it can cut both ways.
That was Erin O'Toole had a campaign promise that everything would be recorded.
Yeah.
Someone has been, okay, so someone's written up, they haven't declared their Skittles. Or something more, more of an under declaring than a few dollars, whatever it is. And what do they do now? They want to challenge it.
Well, if you've been the subject of an enforcement action, a seizure action, you're going to get a seizure receipt with a notice that says you have a right to request a ministerial review under Section 129 of the Customs Act, and it must be filed within 90 days.
Yeah. Is there automatic disclosure obligations on CBSA the way that there is in a judicial review where you get the written reasons for refusal?
That does. They've greatly improved the situation. They've greatly improved their process on that following a case back in the 1990s, I believe, around 1993, where the federal court had ruled that in order for people to respond or to make these appeals, they
Meaningful,
have to
yeah.
have meaningful disclosure of the basis for the enforcement action and the evidence that is being used by the Recourse Directorate in Ottawa to deal with this. There are two ways that you can do these reviews. You can actually send in by express post registered mail to the Recourse Directorate a notice requesting a review, or you can do it online. I've always liked to have a clear record of everything, and I make requests for disclosure, and I also use access to information under the Privacy Act to obtain full disclosure of the file.
Because this seems like it would be an issue if somebody doesn't know that there are these disclosure obligations, they may do their appeal and just blabber all their evidence and what they want to say without knowing that
I've
there's
seen
this
that.
disclosure obligation. So is that just, you got to know that you have the ability and that you might want to request disclosure first?
I've seen that. Where people have taken steps on their own ahead of time, and they say, "Oh, gee, I think I should come back and talk to you about it." And there is still a process where the CBSA Recourse Directorate will give you what amounts to an acknowledgement of receipt with an explanation for the enforcement action, and later make disclosure of the officer's reports, the narrative reports. Sometimes they're heavily redacted or redacted. I've seen uneven disclosure of not just the reports, but officers' notes, because sometimes the notes and narrative reports have inconsistencies in them. I'd seen situations where the officers' notes actually provided exculpatory defenses that were helpful to resolving the issue and supported the importer's position about what happened leading up to the contravention. When you get to the Recourse Directorate these days, as I say, the focus isn't as much on due process or procedural fairness as it used to be. The focus now is on whether a contravention occurred, and that's what you've got to address. For the purposes of the trusted traveler who's had their Nexus pass yanked, they have to first establish that, in fact, there had been no contravention before they can request reinstatement into the Nexus program
Can I
generous.
ask though, like what, I mean, when we're talking about one of these civil I don't know what to call them, offenses or civil violations, what is the standard of proof and who bears the burden of that?
It's on a balance of probabilities, and
Okay.
the contravention, of course, is the onus is, of course, on the CBSA.
Okay, and that makes sense. And then what types of defenses are we talking about? Like, I just and maybe attached to that too is what kind of discretion does CBSA have to say this is not worth if it's just a half a bag of Skittles, and we don't know if that Skittles was actually bought in the U.S. or Canada. We're just going to call it a day. Like, I don't like what is the framework for their exercise of discretion?
Oh, it's a good question.
Sorry, it's a lot. It's like three in one.
Well, look, as I say, the Recourse Directorate, generally you don't have it's all done on paper, first of all. And I have seen some situations where the recourse directorate formerly member, formerly called an adjudicator, would look at things and look at de minimis. You know, like this really, this is trifling. And if you've got the manual, I think where you've got, I mean, there are two different standards. There's different standards of almost perfection being required of trusted travelers for obvious reasons. They are presumed to know what all the rules are, and as trusted travelers, they're being held to a higher standard, generally speaking, as a threshold for taking enforcement action to begin with, than the regular traveler, who, according to the enforcement manual, is to be cut some slack on the threshold for taking an enforcement action and seizure. But when you get up to the recourse directorate, what you really need to point out, and it's all very fact driven. I mean, it's hard to give you a blanket answer, but everything is fact specific to the case. Can you show in fact that there was no contravention?
Which would be that someone declared.
Somebody actually declared, the officer instructed the person to, for example, okay, what did you have? Okay, I just want you to put the receipts on that suitcase and tell me what you've got. With the put all the receipts on the suitcase. They don't say anything more. And the individual fully declares every receipt's on top of that suitcase, and then the officer says, "Well, gee, I'm going to take an enforcement action because you failed to report something. A half bottle of rye whiskey or something like that." Clearly, in those situations, a point of finality had not been reached verbally. The point of finality was, per the officer's own instructions, as verified in the notes of the as confirmed by the notes and the of the officer, as confirmed in the declaration made by the importer in support of their re request for the review. No, I did what the officer told me. He did not ask me at any point about alcohol or tobacco. He did not ask me to enumerate everything. He just said, all of your receipts on there. In other words, the officer really fabricated a situation where there had been, in fact, no contravention at all.
How much of it is similar to judicial review, where even if someone factually, say, didn't declare, if the CBSA has no notes or really poor notes, they can still win? Is it like we're kind of like inadequacy of reasons? Is that a ground for succeeding in appeal or a recourse?
Well, I think the threat, the issue is always, have they made out that a contravention has taken place? And if the factual basis for the contravention appears not to have really been made out, then the bottom line is, that contravention, if not made out on the facts, will be set aside.
So you hear some criminal defense lawyers who will say that if someone comes into their office, they'll say, "Don't tell me if you did or didn't do it because it will limit our defense. The onus is on the state." Is that similar in this type of practice, or do you want to know from them whether they did declare it or not up front?
Well, the civil, the contraventions and the prosecutions are really, separate issues and treated as separate issues. But, the thing about it is, you can always, you can take release of the seized articles if terms of release are offered, and always appeal the contravention and the fact that you paid the penalties and taxes on the item is not going to be held against you as an admission.
Like you keep the Skittles and we're good. Is that what you mean by terms of release?
Well, terms of release, let's say, oh, I don't know. Well, let's say somebody had a $50,000 watch and an enforcement action were taken, as long as it wasn't being held for prosecution and terms of release were being offered, you could then pay the penalties as assessed and still have your right of appeal without the payment of those penalties, of course, being taken as some kind of admission of the administrative contravention.
Right.
Yeah. It's always amazed me in like the little bit that I've dabbled in this practice, and I haven't in years, when you'd see the CBSA notes where they're like, "Well, I thought that watch looked new, or those pants looked new, or those shoes looked new," and they were right. Like I was always just amazed, like, "Holy smokes, these people are inquisitive."
I've heard even stories where it was okay, so that looks like a new necklace. Did you buy it on this trip? No, I bought it on a previous trip. Oh, that's interesting because you never declared it on the previous trip either. And
Oh yeah.
so yeah, I find you
Oh,
know
we
the
had one where they went to the vault. All those papers that you hand and you think like, well, those are clearly those must be going in the shredder. One from like 4 years prior was retrieved from a warehouse.
Wow.
Oh yeah. No, you have to prove that the goods were, if you're maintaining that it was bought on a previous trip, you have to prove it was either, or purchased in Canada. You better have proof that it's been lawfully entered into Canada, duty paid.
I think that people need to be eyes wide open about this, which is why it's such a fascinating conversation, about whatever bling you're wearing across the border, could render you subject to an inquiry.
The only other question that I had, and it was the area that when I dabbled in this would come up, is to what extent, let's say you're a group of four friends, you're going down to the States for a weekend. To what extent are you liable for what other people fail to declare?
Oh, like the you're the driver of the vehicle. It's your vehicle. You're the captain of the ship. Therefore,
Or you're a passenger and you're the Nexus card holder. And it's someone else didn't declare.
Well,
Or there's a roach in their
ashtray that who's implicated.
And basically, I think what you really have to establish is, in all cases, I mean, if you're going to take an enforcement action against an individual, the driver of the vehicle is certainly more vulnerable in that situation because it becomes a question of possession. Possession isn't defined in the Customs Act. Who is in possession of what? And then it becomes a question of, well, are you in the care, control, and possession of something? And I know Deanna and I've had a conversation about that
Well, they're often the
sort of
ones
issue.
declaring. Like, I don't think I've ever driven through the border and the CBSA officer asks, "What did you buy?" And we go, clockwise around the car, being like, "I got this, I got this, I got." It's usually just the driver.
That's right. And that's why I say, even as the driver, it goes back to the earlier practice that I referred to. You make sure before everybody heads north to the border, you've got everybody's receipts and you've got the values for everybody tallied up. That's due diligence.
Oh, and we haven't touched what, how long, if someone is caught in a customs breach, how long will they be having troubles at the border going to secondary?
It generally depends. Normally, you can be flagged for 6 years. You can get an alteration of the flag such that it's, I don't think under the procedures now, it used to be you get a flag completely removed. You can't get it completely removed now, but you can get its, for want of a better word, enforcement status adjusted. Normally speaking, what the CBSA will do is, if there's been a contravention, for the first little while, they will be pulling over the importer almost
Every time.
consistently or regularly all the time. But After a certain amount of time, if they see that the importer has been compliant, they're not going to be yanking them over as often, or that may very well even cease completely. But for the first little while, people can expect that they're going to be pulled over and subjected to secondary examination.
And will
Yeah,
they
like
ever
here
get their
comes
nexus back?
Stephen the Jackal Muren is coming.
Yeah. Will they ever get their nexus back?
You can, Nexus has actually over the last few years, it used to be a
Slow.
flat out. It used to be a flat out. Well, if it contravened a program rule, not a contravention under the Act, for example, or been convicted of an offense, you could get your Nexus pass back. I think it was within. I think you were in the penalty box for, I think it was 6 months, and it used to be that if you had a record of contravention, you would then be in the penalty box for, I think it was 6 or 7 years. There have been cases now where they take a look at lesser culpability and have rendered people eligible to reapply after a year.
That's interesting.
Wow.
I think they
If
probably
you take
were.
back, you can go on the website, the
Okay.
CDSA website, and the Nexus, and I think it'll explain that. But I've seen people come in with contraventions where it was relatively minor, and they were allowed to reapply, I think, in 1 year or 3 years. It depends.
And in terms of the Nexus program violations, is it like, are we talking like, even superficial ones, like, oh, I'm sorry, my doorbell is ringing. I'm gonna put everybody on pause, but like, like you forgot to update your address, stuff like that. That minor could still lead to a loss of those privileges.
I haven't seen anything for a loss, a failure to change address, but they're fairly they were fairly strict historically, certainly on relatively minor contraventions
Yeah, we
of the
had
program.
like I remember crossing into the United States once where we used the Nexus lane and two of us had active Nexus cards and the third person had a Nexus card but had forgotten to activate it.
That's
And
the example I'm giving you.
we were all threatened with lack of with revocation, but it didn't happen. There's also been the weird issue where like processing times for extensions are so long right now. That there's this weird, like, do you get a 2 year extension? Is it now a 5 year extension that we've dealt with?
Sure.
I
Yeah, and
want
what
to.
happens to a change of circumstance that arose during the wait period?
Oh, the other question
Well,
that gets asked is,
you have a positive duty, for example, if you've been charged with an offense to bring that, you've got a positive duty to make that disclosure.
And the other question that gets asked. If let's say Sam Hyman is goes to the United States and just slips up and he forgets to include one receipt, does Sam Hyman's whole family lose their nexus? Is it the three generation rule? Like there's how does that I get asked that quite a bit.
In my experience, I've generally seen enforcement only really taken against the perpetrator of the mistake.
No, that makes sense. We've gone quite over the 20 to 30 minutes I wanted to talk about customs and Nexus, as we always do, because these topics are always so interesting. I do want to touch on the federal budget and a letter that you've penned, I think, to run in a local newspaper. And I don't want to read the whole letter, although if you want, we can reproduce it. I guess not in the show notes because it would be too long, but on our website. But I wanted to touch on a point that you made. You can give your general thoughts on the budget if you want. I know you touched in here on GDP per capita and issues with enforcement, but you mentioned something that you've talked to me before about, which is that the distinction between immigration residency and tax residency is costing the federal government, and I guess provincial governments as well by extension, a lot of money, to the point that you and I have discussed. Like, it's always presented as this dichotomy of cut spending or raise taxes, but by adjusting things like that, how much of whether of aligning tax residency and immigration residency, how much of an impact do you think that distinction is having?
How much?
Not in dollar, I mean, you don't have to give an exact dollar, but like in qualitatively, like how big an impact, an issue that I don't think anyone else is really talking about, do you think this is?
I let me give you an example, or let's try to quantify this. All right. In first of all, the CRA, they ought to make it easy for purchasers of real estate to determine whether, for example, they're dealing with a vendor, a seller of property, who is a Canadian resident for tax purposes. The onus is always on the purchaser of a property to make sure that they are dealing with resident sellers. Because if they're not, under Section 116(3) of the Income Tax Act, there's a 25% withholding, as you may be aware. Now, let's just use the city of Vancouver alone. And we'll go by the November 2016 census figures that said there were 25,502 empty residences in the city of Vancouver, 1 in 10. A primary residence or a principal residence is generally occupied by the owner. There may be some exceptions to that. A property may be vacant where the owner dies. The property is part of a probate slash estate issue. But more importantly, you have 25,502 empty residences. Going back to about 2017, I think it was, I'm trying to remember, I think it was Mr. Justice. It might have been a Mr. Justice Sigurdsson that was the judge in a case where the purchaser of a property was suing their notary public for failure to ascertain that they were dealing with a non-resident seller of the property. The property was originally purchased by the seller for about 2.5 million. It was on the west side of Vancouver. It was sold for about 5.5 million. And basically, there was a 25% withholding on that 2.6 million profit, 600,000 that did not take place. And what happened was the purchasers got a bill from the CRA demanding $600,000. That's one transaction. Now, don't forget, when people are in the business of selling property, it's not buying and selling property. That's not taxed on a capital gains basis. It's taxed at full marginal rates as business income or income derived from activity in the nature of trade. With me so far? So, but let's just use the 600,000 and be conservative about this. There are a lot of properties that will sell for more than with a property profit with profits that far exceed that. Some less, but let's just, I don't know, take even half that amount of $300,000. And at any given time, let's say that not 25,000, but even 20,000 of these 20,000 empty residences would be subject to capital gains. Using 20,000, that's being 80%. Now, in reality, what's going on is a lot of this was escaping revenue. It was escaping the CRA. It was also escaping capture on the property purchase tax, because a lot of what was going on in many cases, 90% of these luxury home cases, is the shares of the company that created the, you know, the developer's holding company that were that was created to develop the property and sell it. They were just doing share transfers so that nothing actually showed through the property land titles office registry. So 90% of this was actually all passing through the property land title register, not passing through the property land title registry. So what you have is 90% of that revenue, when the previous government was boasting that they were making all sorts of money on the property purchase tax, what they failed to tell you is about 90% of it was being evaded. So you can do the numbers there. Now, 300,000 times 20,000 is what, $6 billion? Don't forget, 40% of that's British Columbia's under the tax revenue sharing split arrangement that the province of BC has with the CRA. Now, on top of that, when shares are transferred, given our opaque laws, this is why Mr. Eby brought in these changes to require beneficial ownership interests to be registered. So that's $6 billion in 1 year. In addition to that, you've got property purchase tax. They say they claimed that they were making about $2 billion a year on it. Well, probably about $18 billion a year was being avoided.
Wow.
And basically, on top of that, you're obscuring who the real owners are. There's been very lax enforcement on the empty homes, the empty homes tax, and so on. People are cutting deals between themselves, creating leases, fabricating leases and payments in reciprocal fashion. There's just been massive evasion here. And one of the biggest problems with this is, well, it makes no sense. How can anybody claim ties to Canada and be a resident for immigration purposes, but not tax purposes, and in perpetuity for themselves and their family, transfer all of their assets into the, you know, it's not just transferring a few assets, it's getting all of their assets into Canada, primarily into real estate, right? Without ever having paid a cent in taxes.
Yeah. Now, in
like income taxes.
In the 1 or 2 minutes that we have left, would I remember Harper was talking about changing the way we do income tax in Canada from being taxation of the individual to taxation of the family. Would that have addressed a lot of this?
Well, it may have provided for income splitting, but I think the reality is what we really need to be doing is stepping up enforcement with lifestyle audits. You've got, you know, the poorest neighborhoods in the city, going by the tax returns, are not the downtown east side. It's Arbutus Ridge and Shaughnessy.
Richmond, I saw Richmond's like the poorest
and
postal
Richmond.
Code. Yeah. Well,
but, you know, yeah. I think with respect, I remember when a number of our colleagues were up in arms over the federal government proposing at one point a number of years ago that there would have to be full financial disclosure by immigration applicants. And I remember the bar was up in arms about that. And, you know, every other major country has strict financial disclosure rules. And we in Canada have some of the most opaque laws anywhere. And we put no money into our enforcement budgets. And The fact is, this is costing us billions and billions and billions a year, and it's impacting on our ability to provide for adequate health and social services. And it's given a lot of wealthy international money launderers and tax cheats a vehicle in at the expense of all of us. Look, we need immigrants that want to build our country and be nation builders. I think all you need to do is read one Supreme Court of British Columbia decision of Madam Justice Griffin that came out in January, I believe it was January 6th of 2018. It was a case called Fu versus Zhu. If you multiply that by about 250 to 200,000, you'll probably see the magnitude of the problem. There is no, look at, there is no place for treating people differently because of their personal characteristics. That's discrimination. What we are talking about is enforcing laws of general application that apply to everybody. And when in 2016, the Canada Revenue Agency, as reported by Kathy Tomlinson in the Globe and Mail on September 10th, 2016, said the CRA will not step up enforcement, tax enforcement in the Lower Mainland, which had been identified previously in a poll carried out by the CRA as the most problematic area for tax evasion in the country, when they said that they weren't going to enforce it because of the appearance that it might be perceived as racist. This is bad, bad policy, and it's dangerous.
But at the same time, I mean, the vilification of international students as the reason for overpriced housing, that one, it gets thrown around everywhere. So it's not like we are being egalitarian in our approach. It's just about if this is going to be the policy, then it's a policy of general application, as you said. I think that it's a very fascinating topic.
Let me just very briefly I'll conclude my remarks this way. Look, getting immigration targets right is probably one of the hardest parts of government policy and decision making at any level of government, and certainly the federal government. It is not just a question of labor economics, which are important in terms of providing meeting the demand for job skills and professional skills that are in short supply. Part of getting immigration policy right is what is the absorptive capacity of the country, and that includes our ability to house our population, provide adequate health and social services and education services for the country, and ultimately what the population of the country will accept.
Yeah, no, and I'll link to that case and your article once it's up in the show notes. I think it is going to be one of the topics of the year. I mean, Deanna and I have, I think in 2023 recorded with Laura Best on housing and immigration, and it is becoming, as you mentioned in your article, like there, I think is starting to be a resentment to the government targeting low-hanging fruit in policy decision making, whether that's how we tax individuals or, as Deanna said, blaming international students for housing without looking at all these nuances. And
Yeah, but I do feel like it's a pointing the finger, and it's not that this thing about international students happened out of nowhere. This was a permissive policy that then now the users of that permissive policy are being blamed. And I like contrasting that to what Sam is saying is about, well, but what about the tax evasion? Why don't we actually go right after that and use those resources to redirect into, it just feels like,
And change our tax. I think we should seriously start looking, given how we have such incredibly generous universal programs. we have to start looking at taxing on the basis of citizenship. I know that very few countries do that, but in our case, I think there is an ever-pressing need to start really rethinking this. The other
Lots to
thing
think
is,
about. Okay, what last points?
oh, that's okay. That's okay. Look, we need immigration in this country. We need immigrants that want to build the country. But what our governments have allowed to happen is we've allowed the commoditization of housing as an internationally traded commodity, as well as we've made post-secondary education a commodity. And we really haven't thought through all of the costs and consequences of having done that.
Yeah, I mean,
All
in
right. I know
conclusion,
you're
I think
gonna,
it's about a purposive look at tax law, which is the same thing that we've been saying about a purposive look at immigration, and both are clearly required.
Yep.
Okay,
Anyway.
we can continue this con. We've obviously opened several topics.
Definitely.
We may have to have you back on, Sam, as you're chilling and relaxing and declaring everything that you do overseas when you come back into the country. And this has been fun.
Yeah, definitely.
Been great.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.